Okay, welcome to a very special episode of Breakthrough Marketing Secrets. As you can see, I have a guest on the line with me, Anthony Mativier, and I want to start off, just get in there. So Anthony, we'll get to your bio in a second, but right now, can you answer what's the most important thing that you know about memory, meditation, we'll get there, and mindset, and why is this so important for marketers and entrepreneurs?
Well, thanks for having me, Roy. And, you know, I think there's probably an answer that's different for different people. But for me, if I can answer it personally, memory and marketing go together historically, but also it's helped me personally to remember that people aren't like me, which is the hardest thing that I have to keep relearning and relearning and relearning. And memory helps me remember this, you know, because I can take your course, for example, and there's a difference between remembering what you said in the course and then actually remembering to use what you know I learned from you. So when you mix those two things together, remembering that people are not like me, and then remembering there are tools that can help you actually dig into those different personality types, try different experiments based on that knowledge that people are not like me. That, to me, I think is something that is probably something for all marketers to remember. So to remember using marketing tools, and then to remember that other people are not like you. And so, you know, you want this range of experiments and a range of multi-sensory aspects that dig deep into all those other potential personality profiles out there, which is, again, a hard thing. And I have to myself remember to do it as a marketer.
Awesome. Well, I know, like, going back into your story, and we'll get there in a minute, but you haven't always been like, oh, I teach memory to people, right? Like, you didn't always have a great memory. And one thing that I know about you now, and my experience with you from all the different ways that you've engaged with my content, is that you are constantly out there remembering things, trying them, experimenting, and seeing what happens. And I know that that has it's certainly fueled your success, not just with my content, but as a marketer in general, to be constantly inspired by all these things that you're learning and remembering to use. So that's really cool.
These are the proven direct response marketing, copywriting, and entrepreneurship success strategies you can use today to write your own ticket and create the life you want. I am Roy Furr, and this is Breakthrough Marketing Secrets. Now, here's today's breakthrough.
Well, let's dive into the bio here. Anthony Mativier is the founder of the Magnetic Memory Method. It's a systematic 21st century approach to memorizing foreign languages, names, music, poetry, and much more, including, I'll add, marketing and business ideas, methods, and strategy in ways that are easy, elegant, effective, and yeah, they can be fun too. Anthony writes his books and creates video courses for people who need help with a number of different memory needs, such as optimizing your brain health, using memory training and brain exercises, eliminating the stress of information overload, building your confidence, personal mastery, and business achievement, improving your focus, concentration, and mental clarity with memory-based meditation, and achieving anything else you wish to achieve through better memory and concentration. Now, Anthony was a little bit humble, so he didn't throw these things in here, but among other accomplishments, Anthony has been recognized by the creator of the mind map, Tony Buzan, and as the person, I know his work, so I know he was the person who first trained Canadian memory champion James Gerwing in memory techniques. So James discovered Anthony's work and grew from there. And what separates Anthony from other memory trainers? Well, he doesn't focus on long strings of digits or training for memory championships, even though you can use this for that, right? He offers simple techniques for memorizing information that improves your daily life. And he doesn't hype up his training. He just provides techniques that work. And finally, last little bit of the bio that I'm going to throw on there. He's also a lifetime member of BTMS Insiders and a regular and active participant in my training. And I'm always happy to see his name there. So Anthony, welcome. Did I completely ruin any of my additions? You're not secretly not a lifetime member of BTMS Insider.
No, I think I was one of the early people. I'm not sure if I am or not, but at some point I had gotten the whole shebang, and I'd been on your list for some time. And yeah, it's just an incredible eye opener. And, you know, there's many, many people to learn marketing from. And Dan Kennedy always said one is the most dangerous number, right?
Yes.
But I think that a pivotal thing happened because there's always a, you know, kind of a swipe mentality in the marketing world and
yeah,
cookie cutter patterns and so forth. And, you know, you still use constraint in terms of guidelines and these outlines, but things started to really shift in my thinking when I went away from kind of a swipe based on structure sort of stuff, as opposed to here's a template and still think about those structural sort of points, but then yeah, go into personality, go into what's these larger, bigger ideas that can come through actually just writing yourself, as opposed to reference all the time. So that was quite pivotal for me, I think, in the history of my studying marketing techniques.
Awesome. And I think that probably resonates a lot with the way that you teach memory, because your memory is not, okay, here's exactly, you teach principles and strategy first, and then you get into the techniques and tactics. So if you want to memorize a card deck, here's some ideas for how to memorize a card deck. And we'll cover a little bit of that. And we'll also talk about principles and strategies and marketing and all sorts of fun stuff. So I want to start with a really practical little piece of value that people can get out of this in terms of diving in. So a lot of us come to like a business event or a marketing event, and we start meeting a bunch of people in person, and we often run into that excuse, I'm not good with names. And so I'm not even going to try and memorize these names of these people that I met. And honestly, like I went through your book recently, The Victorious Mind. And after that, I went to my son's first football game of the season. And I met parents who I'd never met for the first time, and I talked to them, and I immediately started using some of your techniques to just help me memorize those parents' names so that when we go back to the next week, I can actually talk to the parents, talk to them about their kids, and I can use people's names and all of that. And so can you give a little bit of practical, like number one, you actually do it where you go into a networking situation and you memorize a room full of names. For those of us who aren't necessarily trying to do that as a memory stunt, what can we learn about memorizing names?
Yeah. Well, thank you for, you know, going out and doing it in the field, because that's how one learns it, right? And the thing about the memory stunts or demonstrations is that I find all the time is that people come and then they use what I just did as the excuse for why they can't do it, which is one of the reasons why I actually don't do as many memory demonstrations as other people do, because I find it repeatedly gets the wrong message across, because they can do it. But anyway, you did the perfect thing, which is to just go and do it and start to see how that works. And those are the perfect situations to do it, because as I talk about in that particular book, The Victorious Mind, it's the ultimate mindfulness, right? And a lot of people don't know this, but mindfulness is not only a relatively new term, but Buddha, the word for mindfulness that he used was memory, not mindfulness. So this is really important. You want to be mindful. You start to remember what's happening around you, and you start to really focus on it. And that's much, much more direct, because your brain is produced by, or your consciousness is produced by, the functions of memory, or so it seems, right? In the science. So if you really want to be truly mindful, you're going to be remembering people's names, because it's the number one way to be direct there in the room. Now, to just make it as simple as possible, the basis of remembering names is first paying attention to names, because if you're not priming yourself for that, then it's just going to fly by. It'll fly by for me as much as it would for anybody else. And, you know, it's not like I now have better memory. It's just I have trained memory. And my memory without using the training is just the same as anybody else. Or as I sometimes tell people, I'm kind of like the Flash, which is, you know, if there's an emergency, then I'm there faster than the emergency even happens. But if I have to, you know, show up for a date on time, good luck, right? Because in my personal life. So, and that's sort of a metaphor, the Flash, you know, as being, if you don't use the techniques, they're nothing to you. They just, you know, like a ninja you know, drunk in a bar, gets hit with a bottle over his head, he's done. Doesn't matter all the ninjutsu under the sun, you're over, you know? So it is the same for any memory person. There are people, Jonas von Essen won the World Memory Championships. The next day he's on international network television and the host says, "What's my name?" Doesn't know. He didn't pay attention, right? So just keep that in mind. So, it's about paying attention first and foremost, mindfulness, right?
Yeah.
So
tying in, like the one of the most basic forms of meditation of mindfulness is just remember the breath, and then your brain goes off and does all these million things, and then you say, "Wait, I'm supposed to be remembering the breath, so remember the breath." Okay.
Right.
And so what you're saying is, like, even as you train that, like if you train remembering the breath, then you can direct that attention at remember this guy's name who I'm talking to, remember this woman's name who I'm talking to, right?
Yeah. It's a chicken and the egg kind of thing. So, because you want to just start somewhere, and you can start with the heavy powered mnemonics, which is just simple. I meet Roy and I think Roy Orbison, or I think, you know, whatever, as a starting sort of exercise. If you want to go, you know, super deep into this, the things that I tend to do, because my brain is scattered all over the place all the time, is that I need to put Roy Orbison on your shoulder. And then I need to think, okay, so Roy Orbison here, he's got red hair. So now Roy Orbison has red hair, R for R. And then, you know, Clockwork Orange all of a sudden comes because maybe it's orange hair. And then York University is where I went. So now red hair Roy Orbison is throwing oranges at York University. And then, you know, that sort of takes it to the next level, which is what we call in memory science elaborative encoding. And it is, you know, it gets deeper and deeper. You can go deeper and deeper and deeper. And that sounds, you know, crazy, but actually you can stand in a room with 50 people and do that within seconds and then recite all their names. It's just a practice.
Because what you're essentially doing is you're creating more connections in the brain, and you're training your brain to create more connections around somebody's name. So for example, there was a name that I had to remember, or a name that I was trying to remember, and it was Tristan. And I actually broke it into Tri Stan, because that's how you spell Tristan. And I thought of it as being like a triple fan, like a Stan as a fan linked to the Eminem song. I'd actually been recently listening to Stan, the Eminem song. And was able to connect it back to this person. And it was triple fan, thinking of Eminem, thinking of listening to Stan right around the time that I met the person. And suddenly, like, you know, when I was thinking of all the different ways to connect memorizing names, you know, that particular connection came to mind. And so I find myself creatively doing that more and more, trying to find the connections with people's names. And I actually think that it's interesting in your approach. I think part of what I was motivated to do that particular breakdown from was you memorize languages that you don't even know. And you're fluent in multiple languages. And even in ancient Sanskrit, you have verses memorized. And part of the way that you do that is you break apart words. And so you're memorizing sounds essentially through that. I don't know where I'm going, and I don't really want that to turn into a question. but I am taking a moment to appreciate how you can take that apart. I guess if it sounds like you have a response.
Yeah, well, you said something that is really important. As I'm thinking about the different ways that I could remember this, right? This is the skill. Is to actually be thinking about how could I remember this as you're going through the situation. So whether it's five people, one person, et cetera, you say, "Tristan, I'm also doing that. Well, how could I remember this?" Right. So it's metacognition. It's not, it's a skill, but it's also a meta skill that come together at the same time. And it is through a process of self-inquiry. How could this work? Or how could I achieve X? So that very way that you worded that is dead on to what I'm trying to develop. I wish I had put it that way in the book itself.
Well, the message came across. I want to get into all sorts of different aspects, but continuing with kind of different practical applications to generate immediate value for people who are watching or listening. I want to think about different types of memorization scenarios for people who might be in marketing and business, entrepreneurs, that sort of thing. And obviously memorizing a name is a small piece of information to memorize, even first name, last name, versus, for example, you gave a TEDx talk that's been viewed by 1.7 million people. You helped develop a memory palace, and we haven't even talked about memory palaces yet. You helped develop a memory palace for Jonathan Levi of Superlearner fame's TEDx talk. And you create content for YouTube consistently, webinars, other presentations. So if we're creating that kind of speech or content, if I'm creating my YouTube videos and podcast episodes, if I'm trying to be prepared for a sales presentation for an important client, what kind of strategies go beyond just memorizing names that can help me in a situation more like that?
Well, the memory palace is sort of the technique that binds them all, because any other memory technique that you can imagine, or at least that I'm aware of, can be used inside of a memory palace, or quote unquote inside of a memory palace. So briefly, what a memory palace is taking that room that you're in, and over your shoulder, perhaps by that painting, you, instead of just thinking, okay, Tristan or Roy or whatever name we're going to memorize, you're going to place it somewhere mentally in your mind.
Okay.
Right. And so when you said Tristan, I think that's what you said. I placed it right here on you. Now that turns you into a memory palace. Now, why I chose right there on you is just because I did at that moment. Right. But if I want, when I go into a room and I want to memorize everyone's name in that room, I just use their bodies. And typically I place this imagery, this association over their heads. This is the core of the memory palace. So it is location plus association, right? Plus some sort of little bit of recalling it as quickly as possible to help the brain.
So, location is a place in space. Association is the connection. Like if you think of a professional association, it's a connection between people, except for in this case, it's a connection between what you're trying to remember and other easily recallable images, right? I do want to acknowledge one thing with remembering names in particular, the fact that you put it around the head and the face, because our brains have a whole separate area of the brain dedicated to facial recognition. I imagine that it does a really good job of associating the face with the name as well. That's a cool little technique. So how do we use this memory palace to create more complex memorizations?
Well, the direct answer is become a student of the memory palace technique and don't allow yourself to be overwhelmed, because some of us are so nerdy about it that it can sound like we're trying to build jet engines or something, but it's super simple. The way I teach it is just simply make a little drawing and try to actually get an index card so that you're not drawing this massive map, because you have the potential to make maps of entire cities if you want. But I'm talking about single rooms. This is actually a bookstore in Cairo called Zamalek, or a district of Cairo called Zamalek, and it's just 1, 2, 3 all the way to 10. And I'm going to use those 10 spots for a maximum of 10 pieces of information, or it might be 10 lines of Sanskrit, and I will write them vertically. So if you look at the bookshelf behind me, I will sort of have words, you know, down this way. And I'm just literally thinking in cells. So like 1, 2, 3. Now I might do 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, but I'm flexible. I'm not really like one of these memory competitors who needs everything, you know, tickety-boo, because they're under pressure of seconds. They've literally got, you know, seconds to go and they need everything. No, I'm more breathe and, you know, allow things to spill over. So I might go over here and now there and over here sort of thing, and just let these images flow, associations. But strategically, there's a lot of bad advice out there about memory palaces, because a lot of people teaching it don't actually use it, or they use it for competitive purposes, which is not necessarily the same as everyday life or whatever. And I also, you know, have a business shtick myself, which is, you know, this way is better than that way sort of thing, right? But
yes,
there actually is a logic to the better. So a lot of people, when you get the traditional Memory Palace teaching, they'll say, imagine your home and start at the door and then walk inside and, you know, assign a location here, there, and the other place. And why that I find that so tragically bad, and I've tested this again and again and again and have agreement from so many people, including memory competitors, is that you lead yourself into a dead end. You lead yourself into traps, unless you're going to somehow go out the back door or whatever. But usually people go upstairs and then they're in the bedroom. And then where do they go? Are they going to jump out the window or something? Like, it just gets goofy. So I've completely reversed the process. Find the dead end in a journey and start there. The terminal station, I always call it. And then you go. So in my Zamalek Memory Palace here, this is the dead end. It's number one, but it's actually the end of the journey. And that's where I start. So now I can go out the door and I've got all of Cairo to conquer if I so please. And that simple drawing is nuclear because you can just build upon it as opposed to, well, I've started at the door and led myself in. Now I'm at the back of a bookstore. Where do I go next if I want to add more stuff? There's nowhere else to go. So that's a sort of game changer technique there.
So, if I'm imagining, I don't know that I want to go through the entire thing right now, but if I'm imagining, I'm trying to figure out a sales conversation, and I already have my PISA formula memorized. And at this point, you probably have my PISA formula memorized, and I use the acronym because I know that helps with memory. But if I'm planning a particular PISA conversation with a client to close some deal, and I just want to make sure that I don't miss any important points, and I'm currently in a rectangular room with a door on the middle of one of the long walls, and I'm kind of in the dead end right now where I'm sitting. So I could actually come up with some kind of visualization, PISA standing for problem, agitate, invalidate, solve, ask. I could come up with some kind of visualization for problem and put it in this corner, and then come up with some kind of visualization for agitation and put it in that corner, and some kind of visualization for invalidation and put it in that corner, and some kind of visualization for solution and put it in that corner. And then perfectly, I didn't even think about this, come up with some kind of visualization for action, which is the next step you want someone to take, and put it at the door where they would exit this room, right? And so I've created a memory palace out of this office, which is a very familiar space for me. And in my head, as I'm having that conversation, I can be walking around the room with the client. And first we're going to have a conversation over in the problem corner. And then we can move to the agitation corner and the invalidation corner and the solution corner and the action at the door. And it gives me, so am I right that that's a fairly simple illustration of how you might use this to plan out a conversation or a speech or whatever situation? Okay. Perfect.
The only sort of two nuances is that you can use that memory palace to get it into long-term memory, so you don't need the memory palace anymore.
Yes.
And then the second sort of part of this is that, let's say you have another formula for how you design the actual payment page, right? Now, because you've designed your memory palace in such a way that you've led yourself out rather than locking yourself, because you could have started at the door and locked yourself there. Now, out in your hallway, you can have another four spots for the next formula that you want to memorize. And then you can lead yourself into whatever areas that you want to have formula after formula after formula. And then if you use certain patterns of recall, you'll get it all into long-term memory. And then you simply will just have it. So the TEDx talk, for example, I wasn't wandering in my mind through a memory palace. I knew it from heart because I had revisited it in the memory palace in a particular way, which we can get into if you like. But this is not about, oh, I must go into my memory palace like Sherlock Holmes or something like that. We generally want this to be in our long-term memory, so we just got it.
Yeah. And so the memory palace, while it can be really effective in a short-term memory situation, such as like a demonstration or a competition, to be using it very proactively as you're doing the recall, the whole point of the memory palace is to lock the stuff so deep into our memory that we are able to free ourselves from being stuck in the memory palace.
Where, yeah, it works both ways, short-term, long-term. It's got both uses, but I generally like to remember stuff for the long haul. So that's kind of a separate.
Awesome. Well, I want to talk about this more in the context of like what you've learned about marketing and lessons from being in the memory business that might translate into other businesses, because you are connected beyond just the memory industry. But first I want to address that big question. So I brought up that I'm not good at names is like the objection, right? So one of the questions that you suggested to me is potentially good is, can anyone do this? Or do some people just generally have a better memory out of the box? And then I do feel like we've kind of addressed that a little bit already. But then the other thing that jumped out at me is, this memory palace all sounds so visual. So what if I'm not good at visualization? And even more specifically, what if I think that you have a fantasia where you don't really have, even though we talk about things like visually, when I close my eyes, I see black. I mean, right. I don't have a visual imagination. So how can I still use this memory palace technique? So can anybody do this? So what if we're not good at visualization, et cetera? Can you speak to that?
Yeah, those are very important points. So earlier I talked about Jonas von Essen, not remembering the name of the host on the show. That's not unique to him. Braden Adams told me the other day, he's one of Canada's best memory competitors right now. He said he had the same thing on CBC. They asked him the host name. It happens to me too. So I don't have a good memory for names. Nobody has a good memory for names. Like this is the point. This is why we train our minds and use the techniques. And so I'm not particularly especially skilled, and nobody is, but anybody can do it. And, you know, with aphantasia, this is the most troubling issue to me right now, because there are all kinds of people who are using this idea of not having a mind's eye as a crutch, as an excuse for all their problems in life, or many of their problems in life. And with all, you know, empathy and so forth, I don't mean to diminish their suffering, because mental suffering is the worst thing, but it cannot be an excuse. Australia's senior memory competitor doesn't see images in her mind either. Her name's Lynn Kelly. She's an amazing mnemonist, and she's a very good teacher of memory techniques. I don't see images in my mind. And quite frankly, I think there's a bit of the dark side of psychology, where psychology is constantly looking for a new term to, you know, create some new journal about, so that potentially they could even create a new drug for. So, you know, it's an invented problem at some level, because who sees pictures in their minds? Everybody. They see them when they go to the art gallery. I'm looking at a corner of a painting on your wall right now. That's a picture. It's hanging on a wall. I'm seeing it in my mind, because where else would I see it, right? The eye takes information into the brain, which is then processed through the occipital lobe, and yada, 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 science, science, science. We know where pictures are produced. They're produced in the brain, whether your eyes are open or closed. So when my eyes are closed, I also see black, although I have started to visualize more over the years. But what am I actually seeing? Is it a picture? Is it an image? Is it? No, all of this collapses. These are the words that we use to express that strange and confusing world that we experience in one place, and one place only, as far as we know, which is right here in the chemical bath of the brain. We do know, or at least we're quite certain, that you have a chemical bath in your brain. And there's all kinds of mysteries about how that we are somehow using words to communicate and create pictures in each other's minds and all this sort of stuff. We don't know what it is. We don't know what it's called, but a picture hangs on a wall. So put aside any doubt that you could do this. If you are willing to run an experiment and get out of your own head, which is where, you know, some meditation can help. Yes, you can do it. And I've just yet to see anybody prove me otherwise, unless they said, I don't want to do this. And my sob story is bigger than your science. So, you know, that's just the way the world works and always has and probably always will.
Oh, I love it. I love it. I love it. And I mean, I guess this gets down to much more practical, tangible, or not tangible, tactical response to my question is that I may not have a good visual memory, but or visual imagination, but I do have a spatial sense and I can sense what it's like to move through a space. And I have concepts that may not feel visual, but for example, connecting the Stan song from Eminem, like there's a auditory awareness there, even if I don't even hear that song going on. So the connections may be a little bit different and it's easy to describe things like you use the Cave Cogs acronym. The simpler version is visual auditory kinesthetic from neurolinguistic programming.
Right.
It's easy for us to describe things in language we have, right? So we talk about going into a memory palace and seeing these things, but however you experience those things, sure, use it, like put it in there. So man, there's so many good angles that we could follow, but I do want to talk about the memory marketing thing. And so you're bridging this world where you have this fascination with memory, with meditation, with you also in your book, you have just an incredible story of mental health and becoming mentally healthy through practicing memory techniques and meditation. But you're also in this space of like marketing and business and so on. So how about we start with the biggest like universal marketing and business lessons that you feel like you've learned from 9 years in the memory business?
Right. Well, imagine a dark basement. I'm sitting there. I have been recently divorced. My life is in shambles. I'm trying to get another job as a university professor because my research grant has ended. I've lost a tooth through nefarious processes involving a German dentist. And I'm desperate to get an implant so that, you know, I can actually be presentable because the internet is showing me that if you could just get on video and so forth, then, you know, you have a shot at teaching, even if you can't resurrect your, you know, burning academic career, which you almost don't want anymore because the social political situation has become as such that you just don't look the part, let's say. And, you know, I'm just failing at these job interviews and so forth. And I mean, this is a very long story, but the short version is Joe Polish basically saying, you know, there's this thing called direct response marketing. How I actually get to listening to podcasts about all this, I don't know. But it sends me on this long adventure. And Joe Polish also says one thing that really impacts me deeply, which is if anything, just interview people. Just interview people, right?
Yeah.
So now we're basically in 2013, and now we're not in a dark basement, but we're in a rather bright but still empty room with almost no possessions. And I call up Harry Lorraine, and I ask him some questions in this interview. And then after we have the interview, he was so kind to spend a little bit of time with some pro bono marketing advice, and he gave me two words, which I never forgot. Well, actually, we can call them three words now, but because I got to know the guy better. But the two words were Gene Schwartz or Eugene M. Schwartz. And he shared with me his history with Gene Schwartz and said, you know, that's everything that you need. And, you know, one is the most dangerous number, of course, but it really was. And it impacted me deeply. And the other thing Harry Lorraine said, which I have totally ignored, was never talk about the science. You'll kill your audience. They don't care about the science, et cetera. But I've actually, you know, just
so
he's probably right about that, but I've ignored it.
Well, so let me unpack that a little bit. Because you're a nerd or a geek, and I say that in the most like loving way. And I'm a nerd and a geek, and I as much as I recognize that just, hey, get emotional, promise a magic pill, don't prove anything. Like, as much as that might work with some segment of the audience, that's not necessarily who I want to surround myself with. And so in business, the way that we speak, the messages that we put out in the world attract the customers that we're going to get, right? And so you ignored the advice to never talk about the science of memory techniques, right? But right. You were also essentially creating this character in the marketplace that was, hey, I'm going to talk about some of the science stuff because it's fascinating to me. Can you reflect on that a little bit?
Yeah, it's interesting you use the word create character, because you had just talked about this the other day on your channel, you know, the notion of not so much the customer avatar, but, you know, your own avatar. And I had gone through the whole Dan Kennedy Marvel Universe logic and stuff like that. And in the beginning, I thought, oh, that's great. I'll be the Lex Luthor of memory, or I'll be, you know, the Joker of memory or something like this. And a friend of mine said, that's the stupidest thing I ever heard. Why would you align yourself with a bad guy? And then I was like, you're right. And I have to think about this. And then I came across the notion of being the Morpheus of memory, because The Matrix is one of my most favorite films. I actually think it's probably the most important film of the 20th century, for sure. So Morpheus of memory, what is that? This is now, you know, just searching for that one person who actually is going to manifest themselves as the great memory master that all of us already are, which is the whole point of the Matrix. Neo is already the one. He's always been the one, yada, 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 right? So when you take that as your mentality and use every tool at your disposal in this great experiment to just find the one, knowing that everyone's the one, then you know that's a great mental model to follow. And I found that very useful over the years. And I've essentially become that character, which I already was as a film professor at some level, which is an archetype that teachers have. They are all the Morpheus of learning or memory, if they're any good, that is.
that's fascinating. You and I could probably go down a whole different rabbit hole. I would need to rewatch The Matrix, but I had my own thoughts about how awesome that actually the whole trilogy is, even though a lot of people just kind of lose it after movie one.
You can't even really think about it without the whole thing. It's really genius.
The fascinating thing there is I didn't even think of Morpheus when I did that video recently about how you, if we're taking the whole hero's journey template and talking about that in the context of story selling, you in marketing are not the hero, right? You are there to enable the hero. You are the helper of the hero, and that is the Morpheus role. And so I find that so wonderful that you found that character where it is there, you are there to serve the hero in their journey, which is a great marketing role.
Right.
So one of the things that you found as you got into memory marketing that you told me was that, you know, we think of direct response marketing and long form copy and stuff being something that really developed through the 20th century and is kind of having this whole new heyday with the measurement available on the internet. You told me that you find evidence of long form copy, or the earliest vestiges of long form copy and education based marketing, going way back in memory marketing. And so I'm curious if you can speak to that a little bit more.
Yeah, well, it's one of my favorite topics. And, you know, historically, there has always been this kind of division between the teacher who teaches for free without expectation of return, and then the teacher who has a fee for their knowledge, right? And
yes,
the person with the fee for their knowledge has been completely lambasted for the longest time. I mean, Plato's Republic is filled with this, you know, oh, well, don't listen to those guys because they actually charge you for their knowledge. How could their knowledge be worth anything if it comes with a cost, sort of thing? When we all know that any knowledge worth having always has a cost, because it's either going to cost you time or energy or focus or concentration, etc. So the idea that, you know, you might pay to, you know, reduce the amount of time that you spend, villainous territory. But what I would think of in particular is this guy, Giordano Bruno, who wrote his first memory book. I think it was his first memory book, who knows, but it's called On the Shadows of the Ideas. And you know, he definitely had a flair for things because his books came with strange illustrations like this kind of wheel here that you see. And this is a modernized, you know, dramatic version of the wheel, but he had a flair for making what he did visual. And he constantly, throughout all his memory books, and he wrote a lot of them, but he starts in this first book, On the Shadows of the Ideas, saying, and in my future book, which is called Clavis Magna, I will finally reveal whatever. And Clavis Magna means the great key. And so then in his next book, he starts to talk about Clavis Magna. In my book, when I finally release the great Clavis Magna, the great key, then you will understand. And then he talks about it in his next book. And so he's constantly setting the stage for you to buy his next book. But his next book never comes. Just these other books come that, you know, are constantly referring to this great key. Now, I see in this long form sales letter, but two kinds of long form sales letter. So it is definitely a person making people aware that he has other books that he's written, that he's going to be writing more books in the future, so that they know him not only as the person who wrote this, but there is an author behind here who has a back catalog and a future catalog. So this is this is definitely a messaging thing, a consumer awareness thing. But the other thing is, he died. We don't know if he was ever going to write the great key. He was burned at the stake because he had that terrible habit of thinking that maybe infinity was real, which would mean that maybe there's infinite gods. And so the Catholic Church didn't like that and burned him at the stake in the year 1600. But I think there was another logic, which we see in education-based marketing, which is that the great key is with you now. If you take this knowledge and you actually put it to work, that is the key. Action is the key that unlocks what I'm talking about. So it's always like, you know, the future is always yet to come. This next book will finally unlock the key. And there's a bit of a Zen slap if you're awake to it, which is, you know, now is the time to use this to unlock your memory. So I see education-based marketing in those two senses, the back catalog, the future catalog, and just use this damn stuff right now, because now is the time to benefit.
This wonderful. I love this as an example from, you said, the 1600s of someone who was, even as they were providing, like, the books are content, and the books, you know, my perception is that you've been through all of them because they are full of valuable content, because they do include the Clavis Magna, the great key in themselves, even as he says that it's the next. Yeah. But as a marketer, he's applying a lesson that I learned from Dan Kennedy, and that so many people have applied and continue to apply, that there is always a next. There's a next, and there's a next, and there's a next, and there's a next. And if you're not constantly giving someone a next step to take in your marketing, in your messages, then they lose interest. They lose focus on you. And so there always must be a next. There always has to be something that they can pursue next that is tied to whatever actions you might want them to take. So if you're publishing books in the 1600s, maybe it's just buying your next book. Yeah. But that has applications and implications today. Even, you know, there are regularly people, I'm thinking specifically of a couple different authors. Let's use Russell Brunson, because he's familiar to most people in the marketing world. So he published .com Secrets, and then he wrote the next book, which was Expert Secrets, and he referred to .com Secrets, and then he wrote the next book, which was Traffic Secrets, and he referred back to both of them. But then immediately when he was done with those, he went back and he edited all of them so that they were all interreferential. They all connected with each other. And in a funny way, this is bringing it back around to the discussion that we had about names. The more connections you give your brain to remember somebody's name, the more likely it is that your brain will be ready to remember. And so in education-based marketing, whether this content is on YouTube channels or in books or whatever, the more interconnection you create between all the different things that you're doing, the more likely it is that someone who discovers you and says, oh, this person that I just watched a video from, Anthony Mativier on YouTube, like there's some really interesting stuff and it seems like he has a lot. Okay, if I go here, maybe I'll discover his Victorious Mind book. If I go here, maybe I'll watch his TED Talk. If I go here, maybe I'll dive into the magnetic memory method. If I go here, like, and you're giving people these paths to walk down. And that's, it's so fascinating to have that example because I don't know that this was taught in the 1600s. I don't know if there are a bunch of other examples of it from the 1600s.
Well, Dan Kennedy apparently had a time machine because, you know, the whole wild goose chase structure of building out a product line is definitely in Giordano Bruno's work. And Bruno makes jokes like Dan Kennedy. He basically, he doesn't say it like Dan Kennedy does, but he basically has his own version of, I could write all this stuff on an index card and you still wouldn't get it, you know? So that's why I have to write the same damn thing over and over and over again. It's definitely maybe not the case that it was taught as a marketing strategy, but I think it's part of what makes humans humans is that we need to build empires. We need to actually create a moat around the empire that we create because there's a meat tube here and it has to be fed and so forth. And so, you know, Brunson is definitely following this wild goose chase methodology. And I think he's, you know, been acknowledged as a great student of Kennedy more than a few times and obviously other people as well. But yeah, it's... we're in this strange world where you literally can write everything that I know down on an index card, but that's not how information works. I have a second MA in media and communications. And one of the most important concepts in there is Dan Kennedy 101. It's called the rule of redundancy. And the rule of redundancy is kind of like an 80-20 rule in information. So, you know, in any book, really only 20% of the words actually contain the meaning. But no one's ever going to engage in any of it if you just have the 20 words that mean stuff. You need introductions. You need conclusions. You need indexes. You need, you know, sentences that have filler words because, you know, even our bodies have junk DNA, right? It's just we need all that. We don't know why necessarily, but rule of redundancy is that most information is redundant and yet we don't have an entire field into which any seeds could ever make purchase without, you know, the field and the seeds working together. We need space. And, you know, back to the memory palace, Megas on Topos of Pentagar Kori, space is ultimate because it contains all things. So, you know, the more space you have, the more you have containment and growth and actually, you know, growth not in the capitalist sense, but growth in the flourishing sense of your own life, your own business. So yeah, make more books.
And arguably, this is why, for example, good copy and story selling. And I had somebody comment on an old article of mine about why marketers do those long, annoying sales videos. And they were saying, just get to the point already. Just give me like, just tell me the benefits of the product and give me a buy button, right? And I said, yeah. Maybe that makes sense if you just want to like learn about the product, if you just want the basic product information. But the reality is that the people who are going to buy are going to buy because they engaged from the beginning and engaged through the whole story. And it felt relevant to them, even if you're like 5 degrees off of that market, right? It's maybe not going to feel nearly as relevant to you, but for that perfect fit, that person who is a perfect fit, it's going to feel relevant to them and they're going to connect with it and they're going to actually enjoy watching the entire video. So I want to, one thing that I didn't do in this is I didn't talk about your arc and your story in the Victorious Mind book. That's probably a great example of the, oh, and see, I've forgotten the name of the principle from communication, the 80-20 rule of communication.
Oh, the rule of redundancy.
Rule of redundancy. One of the things that I found so fascinating about that book is it demonstrated what a good communicator and writer you are from the same in the same type of writing that works really well for long form persuasive copy, because you told your entire story of here was all the challenges. Going back to my PISA formula, here's all the problems that I was facing. Here's how it was so agitating. Here's like what was going on in my life where I wasn't fixing the problem, the invalidation. And then I found a solution in memory. And here's the actions that I took. And it's such a good story arc. So number one, I would just encourage readers to check out the Victorious Mind book because it's a really good book. And audiobook. I happen to listen to the audiobook. But number two, so if somebody were to want to go a little bit deeper in terms of developing their memory, their mindfulness, their focus and awareness for business means or for personal health means, number one, can you give a sense of like what is your story arc that they feel or that they can get a sense of maybe what's possible. And it's tough to condense that story into, a couple minutes, but then if they want to go deeper, if they want to learn more, if they want to engage with you, also connect that to where they can go.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. One of the things from a marketing sense and in terms of that story, I'm not really that great yet. I hope to become a better storyteller, but I am quite hypersensitive to the hero's journey because of having been a film professor for almost 10 years. So I think about hero's journey in ways that actually have been therapeutic and is partly going to be the subject of my next book, which will be called Clavis Magna. I am thinking a lot about hero's journey as a kind of therapeutic thing itself, because I have used it therapeutically. And so part of what I was trying in thinking of my own story and so forth was to go a little bit deeper than hero's journey and think of, what's going on in the world and, what's the prison of the actual surrounding world and the ghost that's really, really haunting me, that haunted me. And, can I actually, as the writer, have the guts and the courage to talk about those sorts of things? And that ghost was, depression. And I gave the PG-13 version. It's not the R version of having to deal with a mind that constantly wants to destroy this body. And that has never stopped. It's just been disciplined. And in order to discipline it, I have to keep disciplining it. But long story short, I was a university student. And I was just starting my PhD. I'd already had a long history with depression, manic depression, and so forth. Manic depression, unfortunately, typically goes into just pure depression after you have these moments of, wow, I'm connected with the entire universe and I can direct the direction of pigeons and, like all kinds of weird crap that leads you to hospitalization, ultimately, or in my case. And I just denied my diagnosis for a very long time, which, enabled them to imprison me longer and longer and longer until I finally caved in and took their pills. And I took their pills for a very, very long time. But while I was taking their pills and experimenting with different pills, I had two field exams, they're called, for a PhD, and I had to write a dissertation. My mind was so melted from the drugs that I was on that I couldn't concentrate on a single sentence. And I was responsible for French philosophy. And, I had to study biblical Hebrew and all kinds of crazy stuff. And basically I was going to jump off a bridge, or I was going to jump in front of a train, or I was going to quit. And then I thought, I'll quit. I'll become a magician, a street magician. And the weirdest thing was, is that I went to school one day, I dragged myself up there. I was more disheveled than I am now, this sort of absent-minded person. And I was at York Lanes. It was the deepest winter that you can imagine in Toronto. They were going to call the military to move away the snow. And wow. these people were there. Like York Lanes, I should explain, is sort of like a New York street created inside of York University. So it feels like summer all the time. And I'm going there and I'm going to go down to the bookstore. And these street magicians inside of York Lane stopped me to do a magic trick. And something just lit up inside of me, a memory from when I was a kid, because I used to do magic tricks. And I didn't even pay attention to their trick. I grabbed the deck from him and I was like, let me show you something. And I totally fooled him. Anyway, I went back home. YouTube was this new thing. And I started to like search magic. And all of a sudden I could concentrate and focus like there was no tomorrow. And I'm learning magic like crazy. Somebody talks about memorizing a deck of cards. I memorized a deck of cards, even though I thought, man, I can't even pay attention to French philosophy here. And next thing you know, I'm like, wow, that worked. And then I thought, all that French, all that Hebrew, all that stuff, like, you know, the rule of redundancy and pregnans constructio and architectonic tautology on cards, bam. Anyway, the story of how I ended up writing books and charting a business around it is another thing. But it helped me not feel so depressed. It didn't cure depression.
Yeah.
But years later, I learned that the reason why it helped me feel better is because dopamine increases, myelin increases, your opioid receptors start to fire in a different way. And there's good solid research. There's a guy named Dr. Tim Dalglish who's doing research with memory palaces to help people with PTSD and depression. And they're getting great results. The results that I had all along. I never stopped using the techniques ever since because they just make you feel better. And yeah, I got my PhD as part of the deal, which was great.
Yeah. So it's, and you, at least as far as I understood it from the book, you managed to get off of some or all of the medicine too.
All of it. Yeah.
Yeah. So you learned memory techniques for a variety of reasons. Like most of us would come to it for a variety of reasons, memorizing names or memorizing a presentation that we have to give or memorizing, you know, marketing teachings or whatever. And what happened was this, it's the hero's journey. You solve one external problem, right? But the internal transformation that takes place is much more profound. And that's happened. That's cool. So I've already been pitching the Victorious Mind book. I'll include some links in the description with this, but the main place that if they want to go learn more from you, it's magneticmemorymethod.com, right?
Yeah.
And you have a free course on memory mastery, which just like sign up email address. Like we know free mini courses, right?
Yes, yes.
Yeah. Sign up. You get a free course on memory mastery and you start to go deeper into all of these concepts. And, you know, I've been following Anthony off and on for a couple of years now since he came into my world. And clearly I respect him a lot because he's here, we're having this conversation. And so I would recommend for folks who have found themselves interested in this conversation so far, just to go so much deeper because there's so much more possibility here. Anthony, is there anything else, any final takeaways or anything else that you would like to add before we wrap up?
Yeah, I would just say that if you ever are struggling with things like depression and so forth, obviously doctors are real and you should consult with them and so forth. But the most exciting finding, I think, is that we actually can overwrite our past. So all that suffering is largely in memory and it's chemically stored in the brain, or at least a great deal of that suffering. So if you work with it and you actually persist, we have every reason to believe that you can solve a lot of your own problems. And so it's not just about memory, it's about solving problems. And as long as you're clear about what problem you're trying to solve, memory plays a place because that's where your problems are stored in the chemical bath that, you know, is governed or deeply interacts with memory. So think of it as more than a Swiss Army knife. It can be its own clinic, you know, filled with Swiss Army knives.
If you remember to come back to the present and decide what you're going to do to impact your future. Starting with, let's say, going to magneticmemorymethod.com, magneticmemorymethod.com. Anthony, thank you so much. And to everybody who has tuned in for this episode, thank you as well.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you once again for tuning in to this daily episode of Breakthrough Marketing Secrets. Remember, check out the links with this episode for even more value. Now make sure you like, comment, share, subscribe, and engage in every way you can to keep this show going and growing and delivering daily value to you. I'll catch you soon for your next big breakthrough.